This is the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Three-pointer.
Oh, Huggins! Double honor!
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow! In your life have you seen anything like that?
Oh! LeBron James with no regard for human life!
Welcome to the AA Podcast.
Maddie, what are you still doing here?
Here's Matt Yoder.
All right, we welcome into our podcast on the day after another Dos Acero result in the USA-Mexico rivalry. ESPN lead soccer analyst, Taylor Twellman. Taylor, welcome back to the AA Podcast.
What's going on, my man?
Good to catch up with you. We need to talk here, Taylor, since the big news a few months ago of your new contract with ESPN, an eight-year deal to stay in Bristol. And I know there has been a lot of movement in the soccer world, especially after the 2014 World Cup. Such a big story, you know, a couple of your ESPN cohorts going to Fox with the World Cup rights. But you decided to stay with ESPN even though they lost those rights. So what went into that decision for you?
It's a real good question. There was a process immediately after the World Cup that I had to start thinking about, and obviously there's nothing more exciting about than calling U.S. games at a World Cup, so that was obviously a difficult decision, and it was one of those where, listen, for the first 3 years of my media career, ESPN's been very good at making me better. They've been very good at challenging me. They don't hold any punches back. I'm heavily criticized, which I appreciate. And then it's also the sense of I look at this as an internship because I want to do this for the rest of my life, and that, yeah, I can drive down, I'm in Boston, I can drive down to Connecticut, I can work with other entities, I can see other entities, I can see other talent and how they work, and it just really was a no-brainer for me in the sense that if it ain't broke, why fix it? And I really appreciate everything ESPN has done, but I'm not going to sit here and say it was an easy decision when Fox, the amount of content they have, and ultimately the World Cup, that was an extremely difficult decision.
I know a lot of folks, Taylor, when they look at ESPN, they say, well, they cover the sports that they have. You look at the NHL, and we all know what hockey fans feel about ESPN's coverage. ESPN still has plenty of soccer content with MLS, and of course you're the lead analyst there as well. But was that a doubt that ever crept into your mind through this? What will soccer's place be at ESPN without the World Cup, without that major event? Now, I know we have the European Championships coming up. You've got MLS, as we said, plenty of other soccer content on the network. But without that big premier event, I think the question in some fans' mind is, what happens to soccer at ESPN? Does Twellman in this new contract become like the new Barry Melrose or something? Is that ever something that crossed into your line of thinking in accepting this deal and knowing what the future of soccer is at ESPN, or maybe not knowing what the future of soccer is?
Yeah, of course. I mean, naturally you would. I mean, when you know Champions League and the World Cup is at one network, for at least the next 8 years. And keep in mind, when I made my decision, the 2026 World Cup hadn't been made yet. So, when you make that decision, of course you think about it. However, when the president of the company is John Skipper, who's a huge soccer fan, I don't see soccer ever leaving ESPN. Even to the extent, if it is just a highlight channel in that sense of for the soccer the way it is for NHL, I just don't, it's not going to happen. Now, whether European Championship, MLS is there for 8 years, keep in mind World Cup qualifiers for the United States, what happens with EPL when those rights come up, what happens for Copa America, certain things like that, those are all things that, come into the equation when you're making a decision. I'd be lying to you if I said I didn't think about it, but I don't think it was that big of a decision, and I don't think it was that big of a factor when thinking about ESPN and soccer rights that there would ever come a time when soccer's not at ESPN. I just don't see that happening.
Do you see yourself in the life of this eight-year contract maybe moving beyond soccer a little bit, trying out some new things at ESPN? Is there something in this contract that can allow you to continue to grow as a broadcaster and maybe gain some more opportunities in that way?
no doubt about it, Matt. I would love to ESPN has made that a priority. However, I want to make sure I'm giving my full attention to what my love is, and that is the game of the week for MLS and obviously U.S. soccer games, and then the European Championship in 2016. So I want to learn stuff. Obviously, in Boston, I've done stuff with TI and filled in there, done stuff with Comcast Sports New England, which is now NBC Sports Network, that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's the goal in the 8 years, and that's something that I would love more so, just so the sport of soccer can broaden its horizons. If I am an ex-MLS and national team player that can talk legitimately about the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, or whatnot, then that only helps grow the sport and gets into mainstream. And that is something ESPN is constantly, you know, talking to me about, that kind of thing. But again, I want to make sure that I'm giving 100% to the other networks.
Let's shift gears a little bit and get to the major story of MLS, and that was, of course, the labor dispute, the deal getting done at the 11th hour. Taylor, I know you were very close to this situation. Just how close were we to missing games at the beginning of this season?
I think what's interesting, Matt, is I think within 24, 48 hours of the deadline, I do think there was a vote that really was leaning towards taking a shot. You know, I'm going on strike. I really believe that now. Involved that 5 minutes after the deal was made, what do we see on Twitter? Release some confidential information of how the voting went inside that room. So my real question is if the players' union is ever going to go on strike, well, how unified really are they? Because it tells me one thing that within 5 minutes, listen. Those are difficult discussions. That was part of the first one. Those are really tough discussions. But there's supposed to be less in that room. If it's for the greater good of the league and the greater good of the players, for that matter. And I just don't think if the players went on strike, I'm not sure it would have lasted that long. Because I looked at that group and the way the voting went and how the information was leaked within 5 minutes. I think over the next 5 years, that players' union has a real go of itself on trying to get them unified and making sure. I mean, I can't tell you countless numbers of players that told me they didn't know what the rules were if they went on strike. They didn't know they had to pay their own health insurance. So I'm not sure that players' union is as unified as they made it sound going on strike. And then ultimately, the question is, was the deal a good one or not? I'm not sure it was either.
Well, that was my next question for you, with the deal getting done so late. I mean, Taylor, there are so many complex issues here when you look at salary caps and minimum salaries and designated players and the secretive nature of MLS. And, you know, I mean, you can go all the way to blind draws for allocation, just how the league functions on a daily basis. I mean, it is so much of an unknown just for Joe sports fan compared to NFL or NBA or MLB or the like. So did the players get a good deal? Was it a good deal for the owners? Is there something in here that both sides can take away to continue to build the foundation and grow MLS? Because Taylor, I mean, you and I both know how pivotal this negotiation was when you look at the TV money coming into the league, when you look at expansion continuing to happen, some of the players, American and international, big-time players that are coming back or coming into the league, and then you look at the league's goals of wanting to be a top-five league around the world very soon. So, I mean, this was a pivotal deal to get all that done. Did they do it?
Ultimately, no. I don't think so. And I don't just blame the players' side. I think both parties. Listen, first off, Matt, transparency is my number one issue with Major League Soccer. And it has been for a long time as a player and now as a media analyst. How do you explain to someone to try to become a fan of Major League Soccer the blind draw? Jermaine Jones. it's remarkable to me that 20 years into this league, we're still having those discussions. Now, if the owners in Don Garber, and they've made a note, by 2022 a top 10 city in the world, Matt, how are you going to do that with a salary cap?
never going to happen. Never going to happen.
So, and on the player's side, why would you fight so hard for some type of free agency when if the salary cap went from 3.5 to 5 million to start this CBA deal, you're getting more money anyway. So what's odd to me is that the free agency that started 28-8, that's not good enough. I understand that the player's point of view of getting the topic of discussion going, but I can confirm from multiple owners that they were expecting salary cap to be $5 million. When this free agency came into what, the equation, that came off the table. So I just don't know, ultimately, if it was a good deal. And I don't think it was a good deal on both parties. I really don't. Because if the league is going to grow by 2022 on the owner side, this isn't going to do it. And signing three designated players and then having the rest of the team under that salary cap, that doesn't do any good, Matt. It just doesn't build the league. And your competitor on the continent is Liga MX. If the salary cap is starting at $5 million or $6 million, you're now a direct competitor to those Mexican players. If they came over to MLS, two things happen. Television ratings go up, and the quality goes up immensely. So growing to be a top league in the world, in my opinion, is not going to happen with three designated players per team. And it just doesn't work. It doesn't add up. Because the rest of your roster of 24 players or 28 players, whatever the number may be, is on a certain salary cap of $3 million. It just doesn't add up to me. And on the player side, how many, they say the percentage is 10% at 28-8 to get free agency. ESPN has pretty good analytics people, statistics people, so it's closer to 7% on their calculation. It's just off to me a little bit, Matt. But it was a last minute deal, and when both sides are unhappy with it, that probably tells you it was the fairest deal at the last hour.
Mm-hmm. That's so fascinating, Taylor, to get those insights, because the league has been so forward about their goals to move the sport forward, to move the league forward, to become one of the major players around the world and not just be seen, you know, as a retirement league for the top international stars or building up guys before, you know, they can get in their prime like a DeAndre Yedlin and then move overseas. And with that salary cap, we all know, you know, soccer is just like any other sport or business. It's all about the money. And beyond those designated guys, when you have those mid-range or maybe, you know, guys that are on the substitutes bench, the depth of quality players, especially now we're talking about expanding the league and expanding the player pool, if the money doesn't match up with that, how are you really going to improve the quality of play over time in any kind of dramatic way? So it sounds like that this deal, it's almost like you see the league as treading water over the life of this deal, and maybe, you know, down the road they get it right, but that seems to betray a lot of what the league has hoped for.
Yep, it's status quo, and that's the only concern I have. It's now with the expansion, great television deals, sponsors coming in like Audi and Coca-Cola and whatnot, you're staying status quo a little bit. And there's a good number of owners that want the league to go right away, don't want to go now. But there's also a good number of owners that didn't want it because they are treading water on the deal. They don't have stadium deals. They may not have made the money they thought they would on their other entities. So that's part of the equation there. But I'm a throw food for thought for a lot of people out there that are Major League Soccer fans. This USL movement that a lot of these MLS teams have, on average, cost the team anywhere from 1.3 to 1.5 million. That's average. So, which means some is a million, some is 2 million. Point is this. What players are coming out of that? What's coming out of that are your bottom of the roster players.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my question on the USL movement. What if that money, which is on average from 1.3 to 1.5, went directly to the salary cap? Now all of a sudden you're at 5 million with no money coming out of, nothing more coming out of the pocket from owners. That's a different equation. That's a huge get a Mets player to come over.
Mm-hmm.
Because the, and the reason why I use that for example, so many people want to say, let's go to Europe. No, no, no. You don't go to Europe. What's the point of going to the European players? They've got a 100-year history in England. A little more than that, to be honest. So why even go after that? If you become a direct competitor, then we get a Mets player, and they're taking this a league of choice, and then there's the South Americans, the Colombians, the Ecuadorians, those kind of players coming over. Now all of a sudden, you do become a league of choice. You can sell those players when they do go to Europe, and the quality of play is better.
Yeah.
But you can't do it on a $3.5 million salary cap. You can't.
You and I have had a lot of conversations about the TV deal, and I think there was one element in particular that is great about it for MLS, and that is finally getting some consistent broadcast windows to know that, you know what, MLS, 5 p.m. Sunday, it's going to be on ESPN2. Right after that, it's going to be on Fox Sports 1. So there's no more guessing, no more always having to check the guide, no more, you know, losing track of games. I think that's one of the great things about the English Premier League and why it's found television success is you know when those games are going to be. Now having that with ESPN and Fox Sports 1, having the increased dollars, is that some of the attractiveness of this deal for Major League Soccer, and how big a deal for the league is this new TV contract and having now two dedicated partners in ESPN and in Fox?
So two dedicated partners over 8 years – huge, no doubt about it. And having the same broadcast window is vital for growth and for also the fans knowing when the games are. However, you can't convince me that Sunday at 5, Sunday at 7 is good. You can't. And the reason why is that for 32, 34 weeks, you're dealing with competitors at that time. That is a, you're having direct competition. For instance, last weekend, Sunday Masters. Tiger, Rory, Phil, Jordan Spieth. You go through that. Now, all of a sudden, for the last 7-8 weeks of the year, you have the NFL game. I firmly believe that games under the lights have a real sex appeal to those games. And I believe if I had the authority to make the decision, I'm telling you right now, this Wednesday night game. And it's Wednesday night because of that aspect. What is your competitor on a Wednesday night match? TV-wise, sports-wise.
Well, you might have some Mac football in the fall, but beyond that...
Right, like Wednesday night baseball in the summer. Well, our demographic, they're not baseball fans. And analytics have shown us that. Millennials that follow our sport, where it's trending on Twitter and whatnot, that's who our demographic is. Sunday at 5 Eastern, 2 o'clock Pacific, as I've done the last couple games, our millennials are demographic. They're not home. They're not home. They're playing sports. They're on. So MLS is going to go through a little bit of a growing period right now on this Sunday at 5 and Sunday at 7. They really are, because I really think they're missing the boat on getting our demographic, our fans, to watch the game. Now, they'll argue, and I understand it, the time zones of travel, because we have 4 time zones. Wednesday night games are problematic in some cities to sell tickets. I mean, look at LA Galaxy, for that matter, can't play midweek games because of their deal with Cal State Dominguez Hills. I understand all that, but do you follow where I'm going on this, Matt? We need to grab hold of all Major League Soccer fans, because I said this to you 2 years ago, and I said it to you last year, and I'm going to say it again. Philadelphia is playing Columbus. Real Salt Lake fans, Portland fans, have to watch.
Yeah.
They have to watch the game of the week. If the TV rating goes from 0.16, 0.2, to 0.4 to 0.5, guess what happens to that salary cap? In that, I don't think fans completely understand the impact of that rating going up and going up immediately on what it does on everyone's roster and that quality of play.
Well, and it's a snowball effect. The more money you can make from TV, the more money you can pour into players, the more fans come, the more revenue you earn, the more money you get from TV, the more you can pour into players, and et cetera, et cetera. But you know, it's got to start somewhere, which is why I think what you've said about this TV deal is so crucial, because that was a big opportunity to kind of start that ball rolling to get more money into the league, more money dedicated to players, to up the quality, to draw in those fans so that when you do face competition with, say, the Masters, you know what? I'm going to watch this game because I want to see these players. I want to see this team, and I'm going to sacrifice everything else. Or I'm a fan of the league and not just my local club and, say, you know, a couple European teams. And that to me is still the challenge here for MLS. All right, tell me this then. We've thrown out some ideas about Wednesday night soccer, which I think is a good one, but I think, again, you'd have some issues getting buy-in from the league on that, because midweek consistent night games isn't something MLS has really done in recent times. If you're MLS Commissioner Don Garber, what's the one thing that you do, out of all the things we've talked about, maybe something else, what's the one thing you do to help grow MLS in 2015?
I would really entice owners to spend money. And so I would come up, and you keep your single entity structure, because obviously the owners bought in because of the single entity structure. But if you throw your designated player salary into the equation, so let's say Toronto for that matter, any team that spends over $10 million on their salary, spend the $10 million how they want.
Would you worry that that would create too much economic disparity? And already, you know, we have that as a bit of an issue.
A little bit of that. This entice the owners. If you're going to go out as Toronto FC did and spend millions of dollars on players, then you know what? Let them spend it how they want. If you don't spend $10 million, you follow the status quo right now. So, for instance, Toronto goes out by Jersey Outscore, Michael Bradley, Jovinko, last year they had Jermaine Defoe, all that stuff. Whatever it is, if they spend over $10 million, they can spend the $10 million on their salaries the way they want. And it's okay to have teams that are enemies. It's okay to have the New York Yankees. It's okay. Baseball has the New York Yankees. They have a luxury tax. It'd be my version of a luxury tax, but also to try to entice owners to spend that money, you know, and give them some freedom. Give them some freedom to have an identity of their team. Maybe a team says, all right, I'm going to spend $10 million, but I'm going to spend it on 25 players. And I'm going to go get 150,000 to 200,000 players. Maybe that's how they went after it. I don't, just change it up a little bit. Maybe give them this league a little jolt, and maybe you do get those 2, 3, 4 teams going at it. But that, keep in mind, there's no promotion relegation, so what's really going to hurt them?
Yeah, that's true.
20 early, make the playoffs. If that doesn't work, my other decision would be to cut down the playoffs. 12 out of 20 teams is way too many for me. And right now, we're seeing it in March and April. There's no real incentive to go for 3 points week in and week out.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be one of the two things I would attack. And obviously, that will never be Don Garber, so let me enjoy it.
We'll never say never now. Never say never, Taylor. All right, let's – one more MLS question, then we'll finish with some talk about USA-Mexico. Which one of these big star players, Kaká, David Villa, Mix Discaru, Jozy Altidore, Steven Gerrard coming along – later in the year, which one of the maybe Frank Lampard at some point, which one of those guys do you see making the biggest impact in the league?
It's actually a no-brainer to me. Two reasons why. One, he's Brazilian, and we've seen it in this league's brief history. Brazilian stars coming over haven't done fairly well. You know, you look at the Nielsens of the world. Bronco was okay in, you know, in New York, but Kaká coming over, from what I've seen already, extremely impressed with his work rate, extremely impressed how he is in the locker room, and he's still got something left in the tank. He's not a 35, 36-year-old on his farewell tour. You know, the way he's playing, the way he's training, I'm very impressed at how well he's done. And you look at his outreach, you know, because let's keep in mind, designated players are being bought for the marketing aspect, not simply just on the field at this present time of Major League Soccer. Kaká will be a home run.
All right, let's get to USA-Mexico. Another Dos Acero result. Even though it was a friendly, how big is that for Jurgen Klinsmann and that team? Because we've seen so many late goals, so many games kind of flip around in the last 15 minutes. So to get that victory, even though it was a friendly, how important was that for Klinsmann and this team and this march towards the Gold Cup? Okay, let's talk about that. How in the world can U.S. soccer allow a game of that magnitude to be played on that pitch? I mean, that was like you're watching something out of the sixth or seventh tier in England. I mean, I've seen local parks down the street have better field conditions that are run over by thousands of kids every day. I mean, it's just – it's abominable, really, that pitch last night, and especially just for the reputation of U.S. soccer. I mean, it just – it had an amateur look to it.
Yeah, think about it. They're playing indoors in Texas. I mean, this is 2015. I don't think U.S. soccer needs to be playing in the Alamo Dome anymore. I don't. There's plenty of venues. And I know it's a moneymaker, but you don't want to play it at Sporting Park in Kansas City. Okay, that's fine. I get it. There's plenty of venues with great crowds. That you'll get your 50, 60, 70,000. I just see, it's remarkable to me that in 2015 we're playing a game at the Alamo Dome indoors. Any time you're playing a game in that kind of venue, you're taking in the risk to condition of the field.
Yeah.
And I just don't think at this point of our growth as a soccer country, I don't think we have to deal with that anymore.
Not to interrupt your point, but back to Klinsmann and the result and some of the players that he's brought in. I mean, a guy like Jordan Morris, for a kid who's in college to score a goal against Mexico, I mean, what a big night for that kid. And what does that say about Klinsmann giving some of these guys a chance? To me, it's very funny, Taylor, because there's always the controversy about Klinsmann, you know, maybe pushing players away from MLS, valuing that European experience, all the German Americans that come in, and yet we still have stories like this where you've got these young guys trying to make a name for themselves with the national team.
That's the hardest thing for the fans of U.S. soccer over the last 10, 12 years. That's the hardest thing to understand. It's not that Jurgen and I have had great conversations, often in disagreement, which is good, but it's very difficult for me to wrap my head around players being quote unquote unfit, players not testing themselves in Europe, and then the Miguel Ibarra's of the world, the Jordan Morris's of the world are being called in. And as an ex-player, that's how I'm thinking. So what message does Jordan Morris starting, what message does that send to other players? And ultimately, I think that's what Jurgen trying to do, trying to open the prism of how U.S. soccer looks at it, it does raise some questions. In saying all of that, I question him about DeAndre Yeba, Julian Green, John Brooks, Jordan Morris, and look at what they've done.
Yeah.
I mean, it is kind of remarkable what he gets out. Now, the jury's still out of Julian Green and will be for a long time because he's not playing at the at club level. He really hasn't done anything for the national team. He did score a World Cup. So when it's all said and done, he did score in a World Cup. So Jurgen Klinsmann, can imagine if Chris Podolowski scored that goal against Belgium. Another decision that had many people raising their eyebrows. So Jurgen definitely gets team players and gets something out of it. The fact that Jordan Morris scored doesn't surprise me whatsoever. I tweeted it before the game started because that's how this whole thing has gone under Jurgen. But I think it's a discussion that still needs had. If players are unfit and players that tested themselves in Europe, then how does the kid ultimately just shows you that Jurgen's boss is going to make a decision for what he thinks is best for the team, and this discussion is going to continue on, and not just after this U.S. Men's Jurgen.
The Jurgen era has been one that has been quite the roller coaster, right? I mean, when you look at the winning streak, some of the success that he's had, but also a lot of consternation, a lot of controversy. Well, maybe not controversy is the right word for it, but go back to, you know, this discussion that we've been having, his relationship with Landon Donovan, some of the articles that have come out. There's been a lot of maybe bumps along the road in Jurgen Klinsmann's journey to try to transform the American soccer pyramid. With him staying on after 2014, bringing all these young guys in, how would you rate the progress of that journey? And beyond wins and losses, Taylor, but when you look at what Jurgen is trying to do to change the culture of U.S. soccer, to change how things are done, to maybe go through some growing pains to take that next step up, where would you rate that progress now in 2015?
Well, one, it's World Cup winner Jurgen Klinsmann. Okay, so the hiring of an ex-player like that, an ex-coach, obviously, as a coach in the 2006 World Cup for Germany, you got someone that changed the way people look at things in this country. And we just talked about Jordan Marsh, great example. So that's a huge success. And I don't care, hey, I'll argue for the college football about that. That's a huge success of what Jurgen Klinsmann's done. Where he deserves to be dissected, deserves to be, I think, judged, is he's promised progression. Now, I don't know if we've seen that. I don't think it's a bad thing. But Jurgen was hired for this progressive way of thinking and in this progressive way of playing, and yet when you look at it, Matt, have they? I don't know. I mean, you look at the 2014 World Cup, it was like any other World Cup.
Well, and I guess that's the question, is that what you ultimately judge Klinsmann on? Do you ultimately judge him on, hey, you know what, you haven't been able to get us further in the World Cup than we've ever been before? It's kind of the same old story. You know, we've done round of 16 before, been there, done that. But outside of that, you know, you can point to a lot of things that Jurgen has done and accomplished. I mean, I'm thinking of the win over Germany, the Gold Cup, the winning streak. Bringing in some of these younger guys, getting a lot of these dual national guys to come to the U.S. and play. So I guess that is the question, is what are we judging Klinsmann on? Is it all down to progression in the World Cup?
Yeah, it is. I mean, in fairness to Jurgen, though, I mean, in its best, it was a very difficult group. I mean, I didn't have them getting out of the group. I don't think anyone did. So they did get out of the group. So you got to keep that. That's got to be the grain of salt. You can't just throw that out the window because it wasn't around the 16. However, he's hired. He is 100% hired for the Belgians, the Colombias, the Switzerlands, the Denmarks of the world that you face in the round of 16.
Yeah.
And ultimately, the Germanys, the Brazils, the Spains of the world. That's why he was hired. Because there was so much complaint about the Bob Bradley, Bruce Arena, than the American way of looking at it. And hiring Jurgen at that time, I believe, was spot on, because there needed to be a fresh way of thinking. There needed to be a new way of thinking, a non-American way of thinking. So that aspect, yeah, I agree with. However, this is what he promised. And so this is our job in the media. This is our job as ex-players to dissect it and analyze it and really look at it. I don't agree with a head coach being the technical director. I never agree with that. I don't care what country you are. I think it's better to have four eyes instead of two brains instead of one, and a different way of thinking. So what is the best role for Jurgen? I don't know that yet, because I do think his ideas and his philosophy on things, it has opened some eyes in U.S. soccer, which is the whole reason why you hire that. But ultimately, on the field, at the World Cup, is where you judge a Jurgen Klinsmann. It's not in CONCACAF World Cup qualifying. We've already done that.
Yeah.
We've already done that scenario. And 2018 is going to be a real test, because I think, and I know this for a fact, Jurgen realized in Brazil, the United States at World Cups has to be younger. They can't have first-time World Cups at age 31, 29, 32. Because the Germanys, the Belgians, and everyone else in the world, the first World Cup's at 24, 25. And that's where 2018 in Russia is going to be a real test, because the Clint Dempsey, Jermaine Jones, Kyle Beckerman, Tim Howard of the world, they're older. And so now how much younger can the United States get at international level? That's going to be a real test for Jurgen over the next 3 years.
All right, let me get you out of here with this then. Are there two or three players that you've seen in this post-2014, you know, we're almost up to 12 months now. Are there two or three players that you've seen in this recent cycle of international games that you think can be some guys that step up and lead the way as those younger players in 2018 in Russia?
Yeah, DeAndre Yedlin, I said this in the Denmark game, is the most important player for Jurgen Klinsmann over the next 3 years, because, one, his move to Tottenham, and playing at that level, if he progresses to be an international right back, it gives Jurgen Klinsmann much more freedom with, say, Fabian Johnson, which arguably was his best player at the World Cup in Brazil. He can play as an attacking wide player, which I think he's very dangerous. It gives the United States an option going forward that they didn't have against Belgium and whatnot. I think DeAndre Yedlin is the most important player over the next 3 years, because if he doesn't, well, now what are you doing? Now you got to play Fabian Johnson at right back or left back, and now you take away one of your attacking players. The other one is, and the biggest question, is where does Michael Bradley play? And it's not a young player. I know I'm not answering your question, but the most important thing for Jurgen Klinsmann is, where's Michael the best for the team? Is he a number 10? And if he is, you got to get the best out of him. Or is he more of a number 8 and playing in front of the back four or whatnot? I think that's key. And ultimately, Matt, I'm going to end it with this. We have no idea who that player, who the Julian Green of 2018 is. Imagine you talking to me like this in 2011, and I'm telling you Julian Green, who's 14 at the time.
I don't think even Wikipedia or Google would help me with that one.
You know, after watching U.S. Mexico the other night and seeing Jordan Moore score, you know there's a player none of us have any idea about that Jurgen's going to pull out of his hat and is going to be part of that World Cup in Russia. You know it's going to happen.
And who knows? Maybe Morris is that guy. I mean, it's one of those things where you don't know if that's going to be his only goal for the national team and that's it, or whether, you know, maybe he finally can become the guy. All right, selfishly, lastly, a guy I have to ask you about that we all love here in Columbus, Will Trapp. What's his future with the national team?
He's got a very bright future. I think his first camp and his first game, I think he was a little bit of a deer in the headlights, but someone that everyone that's ever played with him, and he's such a young age, he's a true professional, he's got a real bright future, and I love the transformation of Columbus under Greg Berhalter. I love it, and I think that they've got a real bright future being a mid-market team and someone that's, you know, quite honestly, I enjoy watching Columbus play under Greg Berhalter now.
That's a good positive note to end the podcast on, with Taylor Twellman complimenting the local franchise. All right, you can follow Taylor on Twitter at Taylor Twellman. Of course, catch him this weekend and every weekend, Sunday at 5 p.m. for ESPN2's MLS Game of the Week. And of course, we'll be following the U.S. national team throughout the year and on the journey to 2018 as well. Taylor, thanks for making the time. Great to catch up. Great insights, as always. Best of luck with the new contract at ESPN, and enjoy the MLS season.
Thanks, Matt.